Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we've got a little separate special episode for you. I think it's going to be short, but you know, we never know that when we get started because sometimes we find more to talk about than we think. And I'll actually say that that's usually Sam's fault because she's got so many great questions to ask. And there you are. So how you doing, Sam?
Well, it's just my innate curiosity. I'm doing good. Things are starting to warm up out here in Colorado, believe it or not. So that's kind of cool. But, you know, this is kind of an add-on to our previous discussion about the tornado in Alabama that killed 23 people. And at the time, we had questions about structural integrity. And we thought, God, I wish Dan Zaner was here because he knows that stuff. So, Dan, for those that may not have heard you in the past, tell them what NERI is and what you do with them.
Yeah. Hey, guys. Good to be back again. And, you know, timing is just exactly how it needs to be, like Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, right? So a wizard is never late. He arrives precisely when he means to, just like a wind engineer. So NERI is the Natural Hazards Engineering Research Infrastructure. It's founded by the National Science Foundation to do cutting-edge research in natural hazards. So windstorms like the tornadoes we're going to talk about a lot tonight, hurricanes, earthquakes, storm surge, tsunami, landslides, anything you can think of except for fire, because NIST deals with that. But we've got a great network of structural testing facilities as well as recon teams. And we've, since the last time we talked, added a social science element, actually out near you, Sam, University of Colorado at Boulder. They have a center called Converge, which is focused on the social science side of disaster reconnaissance and research.
That sounds like a whole extra podcast episode you're going to have to put together for us, Dan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would be happy to put you in touch with her. Is in charge of that whole effort, and she is fantastic. We had her on our show, and she's absolutely wonderful and ridiculously smart and personable, so I think she'd be tickled to talk with you guys.
Well, it might be worth a road trip. Boulder isn't that far.
Absolutely.
That might be fun.
We'll
put that one together. Okay. Well, you know, kind of focusing on tornadoes, and I did a little research on this incident in Alabama, but I couldn't find out much about the types of homes. We know it was rural, and that 7 people died in one of those homes. Have to make you wonder about that. I don't know. Jamie, do you have a sense of that? We didn't really talk too much about it. What kind of homes there might have been.
I think it's rural, so there are some places that have mobile homes, but there are also, you know, normally framed structures and brick homes and things like that there too. So,
yeah, it's really interesting how quickly you can get some of this data if you know the right people. I've been looking at our.
That's you, Dan.
Yes.
That's why we go to you.
Our partners over at the Structural Extreme Events Reconnaissance, or STEER, network have put together a really great data product on their app called Fulcrum. So if you go to web.fulcrumapp.com, and they've got a community on there for NSF rapid things, and you can drill right down into, they've got a few different data points from their early reconnaissance teams, and seeing just like you were seeing in some areas is really interesting. They're you know, reporting where the fatalities were. Other areas, they've got some photos of RVs tipped over. They've got a really amazing set of pictures of the strapping from mobile homes just wrapped around trees. Just crazy amounts of damage. But then in other areas, just southeast of that main damage track, there was mobile homes that were hardly damaged at all. Just the nature of the beast of tornadoes.
That's true. I guess when you're dealing with an F4, I don't know if you, unless you're living in a castle or something built in 1122, you know, it's pretty tough. Well, you know, one of the things I was reflecting on that we talked about, another thing I read about was somebody actually got into a bathtub and the bathtub flew him into the forest.
Wow.
And I guess he did okay. Jamie was making a comment on, well, you know, when you've got a, you know, because it's an inside room, so it's usually pretty safe. And something I hadn't thought about was maybe there's plumbing and stuff there that will help hold the integrity of the bathroom together.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, we're talking about good places to go in your house. Maybe that's a good reason why.
For sure.
It just because bathtubs or you know, bathrooms are generally interior and that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, yeah, you've got a lot of things going for you in the bathtub. they're heavy. they're tied into not just the structure of the home, but the plumbing, like you said, and they're in an interior room. So you got a lot of layers that the wind has to get through to get to you. Plus, you can survive something falling on top of the bathtub as well. If you don't get blown into the woods and he's in the house, you know, you can have stuff fall on top of the bathtub and still have an area of safety with air and, you know, enough room to stay in all in one piece inside the bathtub there if your roof caved in. So lots of layers of safety in there if you don't have a basement or a storm cellar or something.
Yeah, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. We're in the woods in Alabama. So, Jamie, have you come up with some questions yet?
I have, actually, because I, you know, when this, you said the steer teams, I think you called them,
mm-hmm.
when they go in, you know, can you give us a rundown or a brief overview of what it is they look for when they go in and start assessing structural damage?
Yeah, so they look for a few different things. They try and, well, first and foremost, stay out of the way of first responders. So that's not their job. It's characterizing the path of the damage so they can help assess the characteristics of the storm itself. Then they also look for community-wide damage, usually using UAV surveys wherever they can when there's not helicopter traffic and other considerations. So they can see how the community as a whole was impacted. And then they do house-to-house imagery, looking for how the roof structure was impacted, how the walls were impacted, or if it's a mobile home, how that was impacted and to what extent, to be able to categorize the wind speed and possibly different areas where the winds were a little bit different, but then also the types of structures, the types of structural elements that are present and how those were affected by those different wind speeds. So it looks at the roofing damage and how the roof was tied or not anymore to the rest of the structure, garage doors, windows, doors, things like that. So different structural elements they try and get.
And the reason they gather all that data is because they can then go back and look at what they've studied in their research facilities
exactly.
For what strength winds it takes to peel off an asphalt roof or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And they get to feed that data back into our testing facilities that can simulate these in different scales to test new types of structural designs, new materials, things like that to improve building codes and ultimately improve resiliency. So hopefully down the road, things like this will happen less and be less impactful.
Dan, just a quick, the person in Boulder you were talking about, is her name Lori?
Yeah, so her name is Lori Peek.
Yeah, that's weird because I just looked at the notes from the last podcast and Kyle had put up a thing about Lori Peek from CU Boulder and sent us a YouTube link.
Oh, yeah.
So she's great. He knew about her already. That's kind of trippy. I'll have to watch that.
Yeah, CU Boulder has been out there for years and years and years. They host the Natural Hazards Conference every year in July. So it's the whole natural hazards community coming together every year. And they have the, I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, they've had a center of social science, natural disaster research there for a few decades now. And so it's a really great community of practice there.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting because I just noticed that. And I went, wait a minute, that's who Dan was just talking about. So we'll have to check that out. Speaking of roofs, is there any roof that is tornado proof? Maybe not an F4, but what is the best kind of roof for living in tornado country?
That is a really good question. You look to hurricane country for that. It's metal roofs that are tied down really well, and especially with hurricane strapping. So a roof that is tied into the rest of the structure all the way down to the ground, so that you don't have shingles peeling off. You've got a big panel that's riveted in and tied in really, really well, so that you don't get a lot of uplift on those. Or there are shingle systems now that are designed for high wind loads that do pretty well. I couldn't tell you the specifics on them because I'm not quite that knowledgeable in that area, but they do exist.
And the reason you look at hurricanes is because when you're looking at, tornadoes are relatively short duration events, whereas a hurricane, at the center of the eye wall, where you might get 130, 150 mile an hour winds, depending on the strength of the hurricane, those are sustained winds that can last a significantly longer time.
Right.
And then if a roof can survive that, it'll more likely survive the shorter duration tornado, correct?
Right. And the other thing to think about during a tornado is the debris. There's a lot more of that than in a hurricane, because of the tornadic nature of the winds. It's more they're spinning in a localized area rather than straight line winds in a hurricane, and so and also kind of tend where they tend to be is it, especially as we saw in Alabama here, is you've got hardwood trees that snap and splinter that create a whole lot of debris. You've got, in rural areas, you've got a whole lot of, farm equipment and fencing and all sorts of fun things that can get thrown around in a windstorm. And then when you talk about how a house is resilient to that, it's really keeping that outer envelope of the house intact as much as possible. So making sure the windows are resistant to debris impacts. Your garage door, that's the biggest one. And when you look at garage doors that are designed for hurricane strength loads, making sure that stays in place will keep your roof in place. Because if your garage door goes, guess what? The wind has a huge path now to create pressure inside of your house and blow it apart from the inside. So if you can keep your garage door, your front door, your windows intact, your roof system, however it's made, as long as it's well maintained, should do just fine.
Well, that's good to know. I wouldn't have realized that. Is there anything you could build a house out of that a tornado generally can't take down? Cement? Stones?
Probably enough about cement. Our colleagues down at University of Florida have done some really interesting testing with mason unreinforced concrete, so the cinder blocks construction, and that actually is not a great material to resist wind loading because it isn't reinforced on the inside. It's just a hollow shell that if any part of it gets breached, it then becomes a nice place for air to get in and blow the whole thing apart.
Yeah, I guess that's something we don't know a lot about, is how wind does things like that. What part of a home is vulnerable and what is it that, if the wind comes in here, pressure, all of that. I mean, that's foreign territory for most of us. What about the pressures of wind during a tornado?
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's lots of different ways that it acts on your home. You have kind of the pushing forces that load up the big flat parts of your home, like the garage door, the side of the house with windows and push from the outside in. But then you also have lifting forces on your roof. As the wind goes over the roof, it makes vortexes as it goes over the edge of your gutters. The wind spins and twists, and that creates an updraft on your roof that tries to peel the shingles right off. So you have those forces lifting your roof up. You've got forces pushing on any large flat surface as the wind goes around. And then anywhere there's a weak point, the wind will find a way, if it's there long enough or if it's moving fast enough, the wind can breach. And if there's debris involved too, which is what makes tornadoes such a multifaceted animal.
Well, I remember being a kid in Michigan, and I mentioned this the other day because Kyle's actually in Michigan doing some disaster work, tornado training. They said if you open the windows, then there'll be less likely to have wind damage. I guess that would have something to do with the pressure. Is there any truth to that?
Actually, that has been debunked by our colleagues down at Florida International University. They actually have a test where they put a model house in their wind tunnel and opened and closed various simulated windows, and found that opening your windows actually invites the wind right in to blow your roof off. So keep your windows closed.
And once the roof's off, the rest of the house loses structural integrity because it loses that thing that keeps all the walls together.
Yep.
Well, and they used to tell us, you should find a certain corner of the house. I don't remember which directions that was, but we had one tornado warning going through, and my little brother stood in that corner for like 3 days. He wouldn't come out. So what's the basic recommendation? Is it bathrooms or internal rooms?
Like, yes, we're talking about? Close to the, internal of the house that's got the most structure around it. So like my house here, we don't have a basement. We're in Indiana. We've gotten tornadoes here a few times. So we go into the closet under the stairs because it's got the most structure around it, and it's as close to the center of the house as we can get on the first floor. For other folks, it might be a bathroom, like we mentioned earlier, you get in the bathtub. But try and get in the first floor with as much structure and plumbing around you as you can, and away from all the windows.
That's a good idea. What about you, Jamie? Where would you go?
We have a nice basement with a poured concrete foundation, and most of the house sits below ground. So
just go down there with some lanterns and a game of Risk and a bottle of whiskey, and you're all set.
Yeah, we're good to go. I mean, this place is a bunker down here. That's where my podcast studio is. So
I was gonna say he's down there right now.
It's quiet. I mean, the whole house really sits in underground. This part of the house, except for one back corner that has a door that goes out, the ground floor access. But other than that, the rest of the house is pretty, pretty much sitting in the ground. So I know exactly where I'd go. I've got the corner near the garage is probably the safest spot.
And there you go.
That's where we'd go.
That brings up a really good point of unfortunately why a lot of fatalities happen is people don't have a plan for when these things are going to happen to them. And even if they do have a plan, they haven't practiced it.
Yeah. Good point. And having a family plan, we've talked a bit about this, the kids are a little bit older, give them something to do.
Well, you mentioned Risk, Dan, but part of a disaster kit should include a deck of cards or a couple of kids games or something, because, if you're without power and you're stuck in location, you might be in a safe place, but the rest of the house has come down around you and you're not going anywhere anytime soon. It's nice to have something to do and keep the kids occupied.
Definitely.
Yeah, good point. Well, I have an underground basement like Jamie. But mine's made of the original rock that when the house was built in 1924, and there's three stories above that. So a tornado would have to whip through three stories to get down to the basement. So I think I'm in pretty good shape here. But yeah, it's the first time I've had a basement, actually. Being from California, you don't have them there. So what do you guys do after the fact? Are there certain areas you may be asked to go to and figure out why this building fell down that it shouldn't have, or somebody assumed it wouldn't?
Yeah, it's not so much the community driven, although that can happen from time to time. It is, you know, researchers getting out there and like the steer team and saying, okay, we had this big event happen, and they decide and try and find where the most damage occurred and look at the path of the storm and plan out their reconnaissance mission from there. And so they go to the worst of the worst. They take as much data as they can find, and they put it together in a report for anybody else to analyze it that wants to.
So, you know, if there's nothing left but toothpicks, I assume it would be kind of hard to even know how that house was constructed.
Well, but I suspect, and knowing engineers the way I do and scientists, that they can probably determine a lot just from the size of the toothpicks. Correct, Dan?
Yeah, the size of the toothpicks, but you also have, you know, county records, you've got assessments, you've got, you know, property records, and all sorts of things to go back to after you take the perishable data, the stuff that, you know, the community wants to start cleaning up and getting back to normal as soon as possible. So that's mission number one, is getting all this perishable data that, you know, as soon as you can, after, you know, the life critical part of the recovery has happened, then taking pictures, taking measurements, flyovers with UAVs, characterizing the site as much as possible before the cleanup happens, and then going back and correlating all of your on-site data with the plan of what was there. Then you can kind of figure out a little bit more of what types of structures they were, how it was planned out, how they were arranged, how close they were together, what they were built out of, like you mentioned, when they were built. You know, is it a mix of older homes and newer homes? And maybe the newer homes did much better. Like, we were seeing part of this track of the tornado, like going towards the eastern end of it. I was looking at some pictures of, you know, some newer homes that, yeah, you had some shingles missing, but other than that, they were doing just fine. And some older homes pretty close to them, or mobile homes, that were just a pile of matchsticks. So finding those mixes of the ages of construction and the type of construction is a big part of the data analysis after the fact.
Does it make any difference if homes are closer together or not?
In some cases, it can. David Pravat would be a great person to ask this question to, because I don't know exactly.
Well, at least you're honest.
No, that's okay. I mean,
I thought you knew everything, Dan, but, you know.
This just exposes the opportunity for us to have another podcast episode.
Yeah, you bet.
You need to get an actual wind engineer on instead of someone who talks to them all day. Yep.
No, I think, yeah. Dan, this has been a great, just kind of just getting an overview of what happens in the aftermath. And you know, we talked to Kyle about, you know, what the National Weather Service people do when they come in. And I'm sure they probably work hand in hand with, you know, the information you guys provide to try to arrive at the wind speeds after the fact in these situations. But it's fascinating to see how there's some things that go on that I don't think a lot of people think about that make change down the road for things like building codes and safety measures and. You know, used to think to open a window. Now we know not to do that because of the research that is done by you guys.
Yeah, and the cool thing is that anybody can participate in this kind of research. Like, if you've got a camera on your cell phone and a tornado happens in your town, you can become part of the assessment team. You know, once you take care of, you know, yours and your family, of course, you can do damage assessments. You can upload data to Fulcrum. You can assign, you know, join our Slack channel and say, hey, I'm there, what do you guys want to know, and go take pictures while you're part of the recovery effort. This is very much an area of science that is open to citizen scientists. It's really exciting.
Well, I'm all over that because I like photography, as Jamie knows. So I'd certainly be out there with my camera.
And if you're on more of the recovery side, our partners over at Team Rubicon as well. I mean, damage assessment is a huge part of any deployment of TR resources. And there's just a ton of, you know, driving through a community and taking pictures and interviewing people, talking to people about their experience and what they need and how you can help. And there's a whole lot of that going on.
Well, I remember one of the first things I did in the disaster world long time ago was work with Red Cross Disaster Services. And that's one of the first things, because we had several earthquakes in the area. And that's one of the things we did was we would go out and do what they called windshield surveys, which is just to get just a general idea of the extent of the damage. But, you know, you have to notice things like, well, this house looks fine, but gee whiz, it's 4 inches off its foundation.
Yeah.
You know, so that makes a big difference. But, that'd be, not to say fun after a tornado, but it would be nice to be able to contribute some data. How's that?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, I guess we need to get Dan back here to, I'll have to talk to Lori over there in Boulder, maybe make a field trip. And
yeah, definitely. And I was talking to Jamie offline before we got recording. In a couple of weeks, we're having our first science plan workshop, getting some of our researchers from a lot of different hazard areas together and talking through some of the research they're doing, especially some cutting edge technologies and how they're applying those to hazards research, things like additive manufacturing and bioengineering and all sorts of things. And then culminating in a couple of really deep dive sessions, trying to get some great multi-hazard research proposals to the NSF that'll hopefully get funded. So lots of exciting stuff that will hopefully come out of that here in a couple of weeks.
That's awesome. Well, I'm not only a disaster junkie, but now I'm a weather geek. So there you have it. So, Jamie, I don't know about you, but I always learn something from Dan every time.
Oh, absolutely. And Dan, thanks for making time. I know this was, you know, kind of a last minute thing, but disaster doesn't wait for anybody. These things happen on the spur of the moment, and we appreciate you being available on the spur of the moment to come on and chat with us.
Always enjoy chatting with you guys. I really appreciate it. And Thanks for having me once again. Always great to talk with you guys.
If you want, why don't you share, where folks can find out what NERI's up to and, how they can kind of keep track of what's going on.
Yeah, you can find NERI at designsafe-ci.org. We also have a Slack channel there you can find as well, designsafe-ci.slack.com. If you want to find out what's going on with the STEER teams, you can go to www.steer.network/events. So you can find out all the reconnaissance stuff there. And then in probably another month or so, they will have their preliminary report up on the recon portal at DesignSafe. So you can find that in the research workbench part of DesignSafe. They have their report from the last set of tornadoes that went through in January. It's really good stuff. So all public data, really good stuff coming up there.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for sharing and again for coming on. I just want to really give a quick thanks to our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. They make it possible for us to get together and do these podcasts and have people like Dan on. And so we just want to thank them. Head over and check out their information and how they can bring some excellent training to you at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. Also over on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And there are links on the DisasterPodcast.com site as well. So check them out. Sam, how can folks get a hold of you?
Well, the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in our Facebook group for Disaster Podcast, which is growing rapidly, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. And Dan, I have to say, you got a great radio voice.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in. But where do we find you, Jamie?
You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. Always looking forward to connecting with folks. And, of course, over on our Disaster Facebook group. Just go over there, search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook. Ask to join the group. We'd love to have you in there. I actually approved a couple of people in the group today. So it's always exciting to see people come along and join the group and join the discussion over there. So I hope you will join us as well. And that's it for this episode. Sam, this is just more information about the data that needs to be collected, the way that research and engineering comes together to make disasters more survivable than they were even just a few years ago.
Well, it's nice we could cover different aspects of it in the several conversations we've had recently. So I guess you might say in this case, disaster wind is not our everyday wind.